In now strolls Lud Ofori's friend and occasional translator, Mr. White, crying, "Ee, were we having a little discussion as to the, surely I heard the word, Jesuits? Not them again. That same secret cabal of traitorous serpents who seek ever to subvert our blessed England before the interests of Rome and the whorehouse they call a church, those Jesuits? Why, here, we'd thought there was no deep conversation at the cudgel and throck. Hello, Wyke. I'm told Lud's been asking for me." His mum, actually. Lud had to go down to Thornton Levine's, but he'll be back. Who's your not quite credibly turned out friend here? 'Tis the wig, sir. Needs the immediate attentions of a professional. Just when I imagined I'd had all you lot sorted out at last. Did I forget to introduce yees? And ordinarily I've the manners of a lord. Which lord was that? Hadn't planned on this so early in the day, Dixon in a low voice demur. To Wyke, shall we get the festivities going now, do thy guess, or would thou rather wait for thy friend Lud? 'Tis all the same to me. Was your student ever like this, sir? One of these big lads that needs to be thumping away so at us smaller wee folk? Sad it is. Some might find it amusing, Wyke, Emerson replies. Jeremiah, I am astonished. Were you actually planning to strike this perfectly pleasant, though strangely idle, young man? And I thought London taverns were quarrelsome. Years ago, once and once only, all in a spirit of scientific inquiry, I did, well, take hold of him. Jumping back apprehensively, didn't ask me, did you? Nor have thou let me forget it. I only wished to pick him up and throw him at that very dartboard over there to see if his head, which seemed pointed enough, might stick. And he's been on about it ever since. All right then, Wyke. Wyke, I admit 'twas the improper way to test thee for cranial acuity. I ought to have taken the board from the wall, brought it to thee, and then clashed it upon thy knob, the bugger. I knew one day he'd feel remorse, carols Wyke. I accept your apology, most graceful sir. Apology? Dixon's face, as all would swear to later, having commenced to glow in the murk. Why, you little... All light from the outside vanishes as something fills the doorway. Arr, it says. Here, then, don't be laying a finger on my mate, Wyke translates. For 'tis Lud, back from Thornton Levine's, and his mother, Ma Ofori, with him. In the days of the 45, guessing that the young pretender would travel everywhere he could by way of those secret tunnels known to papists from ancient times, which ran from most parish churches away to other points of interest, through that wondrous summer, lads after adventure haunted these dank passages all over England day and night, Dixon among them, walking his own patrol up and down the tunnel that ran from Raby Castle to Staindrop Church, down amid whose elegant stone facing and root aromas he and Lud Ofori first met. Dixon was carrying a torch, Lud was not. "Why bother," Lud explained, "when there's enough like you who've brought their own light? How much light can anyone need just to get through a tunnel, unless, of course, one stops to admire the stonework? Which is what you're doing, ain't it?" He had a look. "This dates back to the time when Staindrop was the metropolis of Staindropshire, with a Y, and the very pearl of Wearside. Right clash amid the best pool of boring talent in England, outside the House of Lords, of course. Where would this ancient drift have gone, if not between castle and church? Either of which could afford it easily, for far less than a single week's revenue." Lud, in his ramblings, claimed to have been up and down every tunnel in the county palatinate of Durham. Some of them connected one to another, he said, so that any who truly needed to keep out of a daylight so often perilous might travel for great distances, all underground. "Arr, arr, arr," adds Lud years later in the cudgel and throck. "Very old, these diggings," reports Wyke, "yet never wandering about underground, all bearing true as an Italian miner's compass between their termini." A knowledge of tunneling became more and more negotiable as more of the surface succumbed to enclosure, subdivision, and the simple exhaustion of space. Down below, where no property lines existed, lay a world as yet untraversed that would clearly belong to those pioneers who possessed the will and had mastered the arts of Pluto, with the availability of good equipment besides, ever a blessing. So beneath the surfaces of English parish towns, bands of pickmen once came astir like giant worms, addressing themselves to faces that would take them where they must. firelit earth walls that betrayed nothing of what might lie a shovelful away. Sometimes, 'twas told, a lucky spade man might find buried treasure. Huzzah! No more of this earthworming for me. Tell the master I'm off to London and the high life. And, oh yes, here's a shilling for your trouble. And sometimes, 'twas told, the devil sent his own dod men to lead the diggers in grisly play, round the corner again and into the churchyard, where death in its full unpleasantness waited them, a skull in the instant of any spade's burden emerging from the mud just at eye level, smiling widely, as in recognition, the torches all at that instant guttering in some vile breath out of the suburbs of hell. The diggers never knew what was likely to be ahead. They had to trust the surveyors who kept above. Remember when I told you, Jerry, that they were the conscience of the community? You piped up that that was what ye'd be, and dammy, so ye were. Thus Wyke's version. Lud's merriment, even at half voice, acts less to invite than to intimidate. Is that what he said? Emerson blinking his way into the discussion. Thanking Wyke for his good faith, 'tis it to the comma. Lud, thou predicted then, solemnly, that our ways would part, that I would find my destiny above upon the surface of the earth, whilst your own must lie quite the other way. Bit further down, nods Lud. How's business been down there? Brisk as ever it gets upon the surface, replies Ma Ofri. And thou, Jerry Dixon, 'tis said thou'll be going to America to build them a visto of 100 leagues or more. Sort of long property line, Ma. Both sides want the trees out of the way. Easier for getting sights, though. I wouldn't call it a visto, exactly. Lud beams. When thou'r down there in the tunneling and can't see a thing, as Wyke puts it, thou feel ever one footfall, ever one turning from collecting the scheme altogether. They whisper together, casting quick glances at Father Mayor. Lud wishes to know, Wyke relays at last, Mr. Emerson's cousin's views upon the structure of the world. A spheroid, the last I heard of it, sir. And I say 'tis flat, the Jesuit smoothly translates. Why, of course, sir, flat as you like, flat as a funnel cake, flat as a pizza, for all that. Apology, sir, Wyke all unctuosity, the foreign word again was. The apology is mine, pizza being a delicacy of cheese, bread, and fish ubiquitous in the region round Mount Vesuvius. In my distraction, I have reached for the word as the overwrought child for its doll. You are from Italy, then, sir? Inquires Ma. In my youth, I passed some profitable months there, madam. Do you recall by chance how it is they cook this pizza? My lads and lasses grow weary of the same daily gruel and haggis, so a mother is ever upon the lurk for any new receipt. Why, of course, if there be a risen loaf about. Mrs. Brain reaches neath the bar and comes up with a brown batch loaf, rising since morning, which she presents to Cousin Ambrose, who begins to punch it out flat upon the countertop. Lud, fascinated, offers to assault the dough himself, quickly slapping it into a very thin disc of remarkable circularity. Excellent, sir, Mayor beams. I don't suppose anyone has a tomato. A what? Saw one at Darlington Fair once, nods Mr. Brain. No good in that case, eaten by now. The one I saw, they might not have wanted to eat. Dixon, rummaging in his surveyor's kit, has come up with the bottle of ketchup that he now takes with him everywhere. This do? That was a torpedo, husband. That electrical fish? Oh, then this thing he's making isn't electrical. Though there ought to be fish, such as those styled by the Neapolitans, cicinelli. Will anchovy do? Mrs. Brain indicates a cask of West Channel chovies from Devon, pickled in brine. Capital! And cheese? That would be what's left of the Stilton from the plowman's lunch. Very promising indeed, Mayor wringing his hands to conceal their trembling. Well then, let us just... By the time what is arguably the first British pizza is ready to come out of the baking oven beside the hearth, the road outside has gone quiet and the moorland dark. Several rounds have come and passed, and Lud is beginning to show signs of apprehension. At least 'tis cloudy tonight. No moonlight will be getting through, his mother whispers to Mr. Emerson. Canny luck, it may have bought us time. As both teacher and resolute rationalist, Pacey, Bourcollet, and Ninon, Emerson is convinced that the ancient popular belief in werewolves, if it does not stem from, is at least reinforced by, the alarmed reactions of mothers to the onset of puberty in their sons. Once, at his first sight of it, he was alarmed too. Hair sprouting everywhere, voices deepening, often to growls, boys who once went to bed early, now grown nocturnal. Mysterious absences occur. The family dog begins acting peculiar. Unusual attention is paid to the roast, just before it's popped in the oven. Lord's sake, Betsy, what are you saying? That our Ludowick's a werewolf? Get a grip on yourself, woman. Well, there's none of it upon my side, is there? Oh, I see. Poor Uncle Lonsdale again, who was released, as you'll recall, with all apologies, the blood proving to be but from a hapless chicken in the road. Yet the vicar did testify, dear, at the assizes, that for 5 generations past... Arr! Oh, good evening, Lud. My, one would scarcely recognize you. And that was when I said, we must go to Dr. Emerson. He'll know what to do. Lud says that he cannot tell if you did know what to do. He adds, do not worry, for it amuses him. Lud, you're alive, are you not? That wasn't quite his question, Maud declares. Would you pass me one of those pointed things? Where's that bright light coming from? Someone asks. The clouds, Ma Ofri running out to look. Where'd they go? Oh, no, look at that, will yous? That being the full moon, just rising into a cloudless night. Quick, the shutters, squeals White, running to and fro. Lud, looky, what's over there? More pizza. Too late, for Lud has seen the full moon, and now pursues it out into the street, White at his heels. I can't bear it when the change comes, Ma laments. It's getting harder for me even to look, though his own mum mustn't she? He's changing, White calls back indoors to the rest of them. First the teeth, aye, and the snout, and claws. Now there goes the hair, good, and he's up on 2 legs now. He's tying his stock, fixing a buckle, and here he is, Master Ludowick. In trips this shaven, somewhat narrow youth, a Durham dandy in silver brocade, Chinese fastenings everywhere in bright gold for contrast, and as a finial, a curiously cocked hat with a long green parrot plume extending from it further than anyone present has even known a feather to go. Mother, pipes the morphos blood, when will you do something about your hair? Wyke, stop touching me. Mr. Emerson, well met. Turn about so we may admire thy buttons. Who's that, Jerry Dixon? Going over to America. Knew they'd pop you one day. What was it? Another raid upon another larder, I expect. Yet better than being hanged. What, old turnip? 2, call it 3 nights, groans Ma Ofri. Every month. No worse than the flux, really. He has memorized several current theatrical music pieces and sings them to me through the day. He tells jokes I do not understand. He quizzes with me in foreign tongues. Yet am I a mum. I can tolerate it. Chapter 24. The most metaphysical thing Mason will ever remember Dixon saying is, I owe my existence to a pair of shoes. His father, George Dixon Sr., having ridden in late to quarterly meeting, a wet night, everyone gone to bed, a pile of shoes left out to be cleaned, in all the great Quakeversal array, he sees only the pair belonging to Mary Hunter. Without planning it, he has stooped, picked them up, pretending to move them back from the fire lest they dry and crack. Who would own a pair of shoes like that? Who'd have decided to wear them here to meeting? Fancies herself a bit too much. He'll have to find out, won't he? George can tell a good deal by a pair of shoes. As 'twas ever the custom, Easter Mondays in County Durham, he'd run about Staindrop with other boys of the fell to pull off the shoes of any girls they met and keep them till redeemed with a gift. Older boys asked for a kiss, younger boys were content with a sweet, which girls learned to carry a bag of with them upon that day. The minute he steps into breakfast next morning, so one day their daughter Elizabeth will come to believe, they spy each other. More likely, he's been up before the first bird to ask the fellow cleaning all the shoes, finding out that she's Mary Hunter from Newcastle. 'Tis a relative who introduces them at last. Something about thy shoes, Mary. My shoes? A direct gaze. George Dixon, out upon the road so much that he has left back at the stables any need in his conversation to dismount, canters ahead. Last night I took the liberty of moving them back from the fire. I trust they're no worse for it. Thou must ask them. He is on one knee in a flash, a hand in each shoe poised either side of his face. Glancing up at her, "Well, how are thee?" he addresses one shoe. "Not too wet, not too dry?" Causing it to reply, "Quite well, thanks," in a high-pitched voice that draws the attention of a number of small children nearby. "Unless I am to be wet with tears of boredom, or dry from too little time walking out." "Why, aye," in his everyday voice, "and how's thy sister?" "Eh?" screeching back at himself in an ill-humored ogress voice, "and have I started talking to gawks then?" Shaking his own head, "I can't believe your sisters, the one so sweet, the other—" "Watch yourself, Geordie," warns the screechy one. Some children have come tottering over to look at the source of these voices. George Dixon, maybe too young to know trouble when he sees it, can't stop talking to himself. Some crazy enterpriser, helpful relations murmur, with a wildcat coal operation out upon the fell, whilst others wag their heads in dazed, though not altogether comfortless unison, and before any of them know it, the couple are, as they say around Staindrop, Gannon Straits. They are already connected in the Durham Quaker web. Mary's mother having died, her father, Thomas Hunter, took a second wife, who also died, and then a third. 8 years after his own death, Mary passing under the protection of her uncle Jeremiah, the third wife and now widow, Elizabeth, got married again, this time to Ralph Dixon, George's father. So, taking off his hat and shaking out his hair, "We've each had her for a stepmother. What's that make us, then, stepbrother and stepsister-in-law?" Yet that is not the tale the neighbors have preferred to tell. They have it that Mama, no sooner than my father died, married his father. "So she married thy grandfather, making thy mother also thy grandmother." Not too much of that over in Weardale, I imagine. Step-grandmother, in fact. What would they do without Hunter women? He is tying his hair back again with a brown grosgrain ribbon. She surprises herself by staring at his hands and their patient way with what has proved to be a notable cascade of hair. As it comes less and less to frame his face, she understands that he's doing this on purpose for her, offering, risking his unprotected face. Mary Hunter was nearly 18 when her father died, and she became the ward of her uncle, Jeremiah Hunter. He was 54 at the time. Think of it as a picturesque affliction, my dear. Oh, uncle, did she remain his ward until she married George 12 years later? It must have been with Uncle Jeremiah in mind that she named her second son. George Sr., not altogether happy with the name, too scriptural, would clutch his head whenever the baby let out a peep, however good-naturedly, and exclaim, "Alas, the lamentations of Jeremiah!" Whenever he heard these words, the baby would begin to give beef in earnest, and his mother grimly to smile. As George Jr. learned to talk, he added the phrase to a repertoire of teasing arts he was happy to share with his sisters. The difficulty was that little Jeremiah assumed nearly all of this was being done to amuse him, for he loved the older children with an unqualified and undaunted certainty, despite the energy bordering upon vehemence with which they lifted, swung, or passed him while inverted one to the other, and their tales of ghosts and creatures of the fell, and the nicknaming exclusions and words kept secret from him, 'twas all to the unreflective Jelly Belly, as he was known, huge fun. Neighbors came to think of his mother as the cleverest woman ever to marry a Dixon. She pretended, however, that George was the clever one. "He usually reads my mind," she told Elizabeth, "and if thou find an husband who's fooled as seldom, the happier thou'll be. It saves thee all the day-in and day-out effort of trying to fool him. Fetch me that, would you, beloved? And upon the few occasions when thou may fool him, why, it does wonders for thy confidence." "Thou fooled him, really, Mama?" "Once or twice. Beware a man who admires thy shoes. Thou may love him to distraction, but at the same time thou'll wish strongly to play tricks upon him, which, though of an innocent nature, carry with them chances for misunderstanding. 'Tis not a pastime for the young. I would urge thee, for example, to ease off upon the Railton lad for the time being, and to concentrate upon thy sums. Remember, she who keepeth the books runneth the business." "He's so..." Yes. Oh, thou don't know? I know thee. A quick sweep of her palm down the girl's hair. I see that gawpy look. His father died when Jeremiah was 22, a fairly miserable stretch beginning for him then, though he never drank enough to interfere with field work, something he needed as much as ready access to ale, still young enough to arise little inconvenienced after a night's strenuous drinking, having led till now the merry life of a journeyman surveyor, errant all through the North Country, one great land holding to another, three-legged staff cocked over his shoulder, circumferenter slung in a pitman's bag along with dry stockings and a small wheaten loaf, spare needles and pins, plummets, pencils, scrap paper, and jeweler's putty for the compass. Those spaces not yet enclosed would ever make him uneasy, not a promising mental condition for an outdoor job, obliged to cross the fell now and again, a dangerous and frightening place, not only murderers abroad, but spirits as well, and spirits not necessarily in human form. No, the worst being, almost in human form, but not quite. Now he longed only, late at night, whispering to the familiar floorboards, either to be killed and devoured out there, or to become one of them, predatory and forever unsheltered, either way, transformed. He broke faith with everyone he knew. Loans unhonored, errands unrun, silences unkept. His older sister, Hannah, married a Yorkshireman but 3 months after their father's passing, and Jerry showed up at the wedding and made a spectacle of himself. "I'm but getting on with it, Jeremiah, and so ought thee, and who are thee to call me such things?" He was turning into a country lout, soon to be beyond reclamation. Elizabeth, tearful and broken, had headed directly for the comfort of her mother, both assumed into a silent, unapproachable cloud of mourning, the boys being left each to his own way of soldiering on, the enemy who'd so unanswerably insulted them at their backs now somewhere and in and out of their sleep. George got busier than he had to be with one scheme and another, pulling greenstone out of the dike under Cockfield Fell, carving and fitting together stalks of hemlock for another of his gas pipe schemes, redesigning the spur gearing or the pump seals out at the workings. Jeremiah found himself indoors, perfecting his draftsmanship, bending all day over the work table, grinding and mixing his own inks, siftings and splashes everywhere of King's Yellow, Azure, Red Orpiment, Indian Lake, Verdigris, Indigo, and Umber. Levigating, elutriating, mixing the gum water, pouncing and rosining the paper to prevent soak through, preparation he would once rashly have hurried round or in great part omitted, was now necessary, absolutely necessary, to do right. He must, if one day called upon, produce an overhead view of a world that never was, in truth-like detail, one he'd begun in silence to contrive. A map entirely within his mind of a world he could escape to, if he had to. If he had to, he would enter it entirely, but never get lost, for he would have this map, and in it, spread below, would lie everything. Mountain of glass, sea of sand, miraculous springs, volcanoes, sacred cities, mile-deep chasm, serpent's cave, endless prairie, another chapbook fancy with each deviation and dip of the needle. When night fell, he would put his drafting things away, back into their velvet nests and pearwood cases, and go out to the tiger or the greyhound, seeking men who'd been friends of his father's, seeking somehow to nod and smile them into remembering. Much of the ale-born matiness others were to see in him was learned during this time, at great effort, a word, a gesture at a time. They told him often of things he didn't know, or thought he didn't, of the coal business. Iliads of never quite straightforward dealings among owners, stathemen, collier masters, and fitters, who might have owned a particular keel and who hadn't but said he did. 'Twas ever something, for whilst business Tyneside might be done by one-year contracts and fixed fees, here upon the weir, all was negotiable. Just before leaving for America, he spends as much time as he may at the Jolly Pitman, though now he is more likely to be the storyteller. Some are gone, yet there are some who say, "George would be proud of thee now." "Will ye come with wee Dodd and me on my keel, as ye did last time, Jerry?" "Why, aye, Mr. Snow, and I thank thee." So it is he now approaches the harbor, down the river widening out of darkness into a dawn singing of stathemen and keel bullies. "Now there, hey, watcher!" The fleets of keels carried down and sailing upstream, the beamwork of the first staves penned upon the sunrise, both sides of the river a rumble with the coal in the chutes and the coal-filled wagons upon the wood rails. The dyer's bath of morning, no redder than twopenny beer, spilling across the world east of Chesterley Street, punctuated by the geometry of tunnels, bridges, and earthwork embankments sizable as pyramids, the great inclined wagonways, whose tracks run from the mine heads inland for miles down to the spouts upon Weir. America waiting someplace. Going out to the collier, Mary and Meg, bound again for London River, riding atop the Huddock, Dixon sees fog, pale and shifting, approach like a great predatory worm. He has snickered at gin shop tales of keelmen lost in the fog, never expecting any such mishap in his own life, having ever planned to spend as much of it as he may upon dry land. But here it comes, the flanks of the aqueous creature seething ever closer, as young Dodd, the PD, gives a shout of alarm, and Mr. Snow, in his post of keel bully, begins to swear vigorously. Already half the shoreline is obscured. Far away upon the shields, a bell buoy rings in the dank morning, and somewhere closer, upon now invisible rounds, yet goes the bell of the Tagarine man, ship to ship, iron seeking iron. And then, like that, wrapped in the sulphurous signature of fresh coal, have a score of savages appeared out of the sea fret, paddling pirogues, shouting strange jibber-jabber, the words incomprehensible, yet the vowels unmistakably North British. How to explain this? That wild Indian sounds a bit like poor old Cookie, don't it? They've painted themselves. Aye, black as coal dust. How ye, calls Mr. Snow, what place is this? Why, ye floated to America, ye buggers. Here, we'll fo' yous in. America, eh? Hey. Ye, ye gawks! A grappling hook, blackened and lethal, comes flying out of the fret, just missing young Dodd and catching the Huddock. They're attacking, screams the PD, scrabbling in the coal. And just then, out there, like hounds let loose, the church bells of America all begin to toll, peculiarly lucid in the fog, a dense carillon, tuned so exotically they might be playing anything. Methodist hymns, opera hall airs, jigs and jigs, worked songs of sailors, Italian serenades, British ballads, American marches. Now listen, hear ye's, the keel bully to forces invisible. There's naught to fear from us, being but poor peaceable folk lost in this uncommon fret, who'll be only too pleased to gone with yous, where ye say. In a lower voice to his own, they want the coal, let them find us. Carefully, sensing the tides through his souls, he steers them further into the obscurity. The others, keeping silent, may be anywhere. Snow reacts to every splash, every shift of whatever is flowing past. Soon the fog begins to clear. They seem to rock beneath the belfries of a great estuarial town. It smells like coal. Ordinary water birds, coast above, quite at home. Why, I believe they're Geordies, as much as us, the keel bully exclaims. Nor do they appear the faces of strangers. Yet where are keelmen ever as silent as these have now fallen? And why are the faces beneath these basin crops so unmovingly resentful? Snow and even little Dodd know them. Some stood before the assizes after the strikes of 43 and 50 and were sentenced to the gallows, though 'twas later said they were transported to America. Why, aye, if this be America, then here they are, in company with alehouse champions of legend carrying their blackjacks big as washing tubs, celebrated free-for-all heroes, keel racers from the Coley Tyne, worshipped even Wearside. Dobby, is it you? What cheer? As if for Dixon, every fizz a reel, every can bought and taken, a nocturnal voice lifted in harmony, down his time, sooner or later would come to be reprised in this late-day invisibility. And the fret, for a moment, has made possible some America no traveler's account has yet described, because as yet none has returned, though many be the mates and dear ones who bide. And when he sees the little collier brig at last, her sails not merely begrimed, but silken black with coal dust, the Mary and Meg, Dixon suffers a moment and a half of dread, for her stillness in the water, her evenness of trim in a light, never seen upon the shields. Was it so the first time? Did he simply miss it, with his mind then pitched so immoderately further east? Or is this a particular and strong message concerning America, meant not for him but for someone else, that he may only have got in the way of? It is dangerous passage along the coast down to the Thames and into the pool, turning ever to windward, often into the teeth of gales, among treacherous sands, and the channels ever recurving like great serpents astir. Catching a windward tide at the King's Channel, beating up toward the Swin, keeping out of the swatchways and attending ever her soundings, the Mary and Meg, threading nicely among rocks, shallows, a thousand other vessels, each bound its own way, desiring, despite her ghostly look, to live briskly whilst she may, brings Dixon at last to Long Reach, above Gravesend, guided to her moorage in the Tier by the slowly rising dome of St. Paul's to westward. Tomorrow, he and Mason are to sign the contract. Chapter 25. Miss Tenebry, perplexed, puts down her embroidery. This case, Uncle, languished in court for 80 years. Yet just when Mason and Dixon happen to find themselves nicely between transits of Venus, suddenly everyone agrees there shall be the survey in America. Aren't you at least suspicious? You dark girl, must all be enigmata? The celestial events were 8 years apart, the term beyond human arrangement. Had the survey taken longer, they'd have likely observed the second transit from somewhere in America. As it was, running the line would take them 4 of those years, with an extra year for measuring a degree of latitude in Delaware. The days before their departure are humid, splashed into repeatedly by rain. Upon their meeting again in London, after a year and a half, to sign their contract with the proprietors, who arrive backed by agents, lawyers, and bullies, Dixon, as soon as it is possible to do so, the sketch artists having dashed in a few last details and crept away, takes off his hat. "I was saddened to hear of Dr. Bradley's death, sir." "Thank you for the letter you wrote, Jeremiah." Without agreeing to it, they find themselves, if but for form's sake, out roistering in what proves to be a sort of sustained flow of strong drink, in which Mason will obscurely recall being included gin and gin's Hogarthian society, winding up a fortnight later in the unpromising streets of Falmouth, a town dedicated to swift communication, all hurry, huge sums at stake, veterinarians in coaches and six, brokers of news to and fro at the gallop, last-minute courier's pouches, dilatory visitors swimming back to shore from another precise departure, even as the next packet after her makes ready to put to sea. Mason's nose approaches the surface of his ale, withdraws, approaches again. Presently, "If I only might have spoken with Bradley. You recall our departure from Plymouth, I?" He had put himself then to the labor of coming down, between appointments with Payne, for the final illness, as they said, was from gravel. Upon the landing, he kept apart from the others, even from cheery Mr. Birch, who was everywhere at once. Mr. Meade and Mr. White pointing to various lines and tackle and correcting one another's terminology, while betwixt Dr. Bradley and me, silent conversation passed. Mason's brow clearly unhappy. I believe he had come to apologize, giving away this solemn confidence snappily, as another might the punchline of a joke. For, as I often noted, no matter what sentiments might lie upon his phiz, Mr. Mason was in the habit of delivering even his gravest speeches with the rhythms and inflections of the taproom comedian. I was loading an unreasonable weight of hope upon that mission, upon the purity of the event. Look ye at what I intended to escape. Rebecca lost, my anchor to all I knew of birth and death, I was adrift in waters unknown, intrigues and faction within the Royal Society, as among nations and chartered companies. Foolishly seeking in the alignment of sun, Venus, and earth, a moment redeemed from the impurity in which I must ever practice my life, instead even this pitiable hope is interdicted by the deadly Legrand, not at war with the sciences, Poe. In plain text, that brass voice announced, "The business of the world is trade and death, and you must engage with that unpleasantness as the price of your not at all assured moment of purity, fool." "Hey, thou were translating all thy French jabber? Hardly a bonny sentiment, Mr. Mason." Mr. Dixon, I am certain that you, as the unwavering lark of the Sanguine, will find us a way past that. Dixon's smile, acknowledging the pronoun, I imagine, he says carefully, such moments to lie beyond any price that might be named. Oh, I've had 'em for half a crown sometimes, Mason mutters, though, of course, your own experience. Here's the Dodd man. Might we go in this one, do thou guess? Why not? What's it matter? Savages, wilderness, no one even knows what's out there. And we have just, do you appreciate, contracted to place a line directly through it. Doesn't it strike you as a little unreasonable? Not to mention the Americans. Excuse me? They are at least all British there, aren't they? The place is but a patch of England at a 3,000-mile offset, isn't it? Hey, thou can be so thoughtful, help and cheer me up with thy jokes, Mason. I'm fine, really. Dixon, hold. Are you telling me now that Americans are not British? You've heard this somewhere? No more than the Cape Dutch are Dutch. 'Tis said these people keep slaves, as did our late hosts, that they are likewise inclined to kill the people already living there where they wish to settle. Another slave colony, so have I heard as well. Christ. This from Quakers of Durham, whose relations have gone there and written back. There may be redeeming qualities to the place. Who knows? The food, the lasses, whatever else there is. The pay, I suppose. Being from Staindrop, Dixon declares, 'tis seldom at much personal ease that I discuss the unpriceable. Yet our last time out, all for an event that would occupy a few hours, in some places but minutes, even with the late war as precedent, hundreds of lives for some log palisado, thousands in sterling for some handful of savages' scalps. Even so, that transit made no market sense, what so fairly ever. You think they paid us too much? Fear of enthusiasm immediately entering Mason's gaze. There were moments when they must have thought so, such as, never mind. A certain exchange of letters, correct? I didn't say that. The letter to Bradley? You think that's what put us in the stifata? That when we signed the letter, we signed our careers away? Yet look ye here, we're hired again, aren't we? Out of nowhere. Surely we are rehabilitated. All suspicions washed away in the stream of time. All resentments by starlight healed. What did we even do that has to be absolved? We represented our unwillingness to proceed upon a fool's errand. Aye, and they replied that we were cowards and must proceed. Just so. Whereupon we touched our hats, obeyed, and sailed off in the same ship that had nearly been blown out from under us. We did our duty. And more, not only getting for them their damned transit observations, but with all their damned longitude. Their cursed local gravity. Dammy Dixon, 'twas first-rate work. Surely that has preponderated against one letter to Bradley, rest his soul, yet I cannot speak easily, even now, of my dismay at how he'd used me. You mean Huzz? Very well, though as to who may have felt more piercingly the harshness of the reply, having presumed, alas so foolishly, some connection deeper than this hateful unending Royal Society intrigue. Their infamy's no fresh news to me, Dixon quietly. What we must face is the probability that from now on, though we fight like Alexander and labor like Hercules, we shall always be remembered as the stargazers who turn tail under fire. So might I have done, cries Mason, had there been but room to turn it. The irony how keen. Eh, well, I wasn't as scared as thou, though of course I did feel. Old, who said I was scared? Who, did I? Were you scared? I wasn't scared. You thought I was scared? I thought you were scared. I do recall a disinclination, as who would not, to perish beneath the waterline of some, forgive me, miserable sixth rate. Sounds like headlong panic to me, says Mason. Thank goodness I was calmer about it. Calmer than what? An hour and a half of great hellish explosions and mortal screaming? Aye, serenity. We'll make a Quaker of thee yet. They decertify me out of astronomy, strictly C of E in this trade. I'd never micro in on another star in that town again. All the pubs in Greenwich shone my likeness. Arr! I cannot sound why they've hired us again. Nor I. They believe, however, that we do know why. In London, they credit us with a depth of motive at least equal to their own. They have to, otherwise they but spin, to no purpose. One may be altogether innocent of depth. Well, take yourself, for example, forthright son of the Fells, or if you like, blunt Geordie. Yet I'm no stranger to intriguing. Why, thou need go no further than bishop for thou, though there's plenty in Staindrop for fair. Yet are Londoners ever askan, every word thou speak, every twitch of thy fizz, for further meanings, present or not. They've but lately discovered simple metaphors. Then ye find too late ye've insulted them, or been quietly classified or slandered, never knowing quite which word or gesture has done the job. 'Tis called, I believe, being from the country. Mason lets his head abruptly drop. Yet I thought I had quite got the Thames side way of talking, the philosophical parlance, the fashions of the day, that the bumpkin within had been entirely subdued. In Bishop, we say, ye may take the boy out of the country. Yes, yes, but never the country out of the boy. No, that's not it, but thou'll never take the girl out of the cities, how we say it. Mason is staring, shaking his head. What does that mean? Something about women. You don't believe that they've forgiven us at the Royal Society? Nor ever shall. Though eventually 'tis they who'll look hasty and childish, whilst we'll be deemed to've shown a higher order of courage than the world at present recognizes. Eventually? Oh, dear. Why, aye, we shan't live to see it. So I shall die a documented coward, splendid, attainted before the ages, my sons as well. Oh, thank you, Dixon, that's wonderful. That cheers me prodigious. Or, Dixon, trying to speak clearly, coadjutor in an honorable act of defiance, taken in the full knowledge that those bastards upon high would slap us down. Oh, not I, as Chauncey said when the bums came in. I didn't assume any such thing, did you? That we were bound to fail? He shakes his head vigorously, as if there is something upon it that he wishes to dislodge. Why on earth did you sign the letter? Dixon shrugs. Emerson was right about them. They're evil folk, the lot, your Royal Society. We had to resist them somehow. Or, expressing it more hopefully, we tried to make a positive suggestion as to an alternative station, reachable in time, taken from a list well known to all. Your suggestion of Scandaroon was particularly unfortunate, Maskline had rushed to advise Mason, having led him into a critique of his Cape mission which seemed to consist of every, to Maskline, flawed decision Mason had made. How? Mason protested. It wasn't my idea. Scandaroon was ever listed as one of the alternates. The little muskrat. His eyes were unable to come to rest. He paced about far too energetically. I don't suppose Mr. Peach has ever spoken to you of the Levant Company, of that lively traffic in muslins and bombazines passing through Aleppo to the sea and the warehouses of the factors at Scandaroon. Mr. Peach does business with Aleppo. No one who has learned silk can afford not to, Mason replied. Yet, alas, unaccountably, it has remained absent from our discourse. Jews, declared Maskline, regretting it in the instant. Let me see if I'm following this. The Royal Society sent Dixon and me to the Cape, thus incurring a debt owed to Dutchmen rather than to Jews, which any stationing of astronomers at Scandaroon would imply. Hastily, he goes on to explain, now says Mason to Dixon, that overtures must be made by way of the East India Company, whose westernmost station is at Baghdad. Thence, up the valley of the Euphrates, by way of Mosul, to Aleppo, which is the Turkey Company's easternmost factory, runs a private communication. Feluccas, flights of miraculous doves, couriers with astonishing memories, rolling egrets of messages, few upon paper, upstream and down, having long connected, to a great reach of intimacy, the two companies. For astronomers at St. Helena, or even at Ben Coulon, all would be arranged straightforwardly, a clear debt of gratitude. But for services of any complexity, well, the fees start going up. The company's duty is not so clear. particularly as the Turkey Company's route to India goes on losing custom to the fleets that Honorable John keeps a-slinging each day round the Cape into those prodigious winds. And whilst Janissaries, sheriffs, and Ottomans struggle to determine who shall rule over the decline. What would Jews have required of them that Dutchmen would not? Is this another riddle? Not wishing this to be taken as any but a twinge of curiosity, says Dixon, why has every observation site proposed by the Royal Society proved to be a factory or consulate or other agency of some royally chartered company? Excuse me, you'd rather be dropped blindly into a forest on some little-known continent, perhaps? No, perimeters, nor indeed chances of surviving, intriguing, as the monkey said. I think not. Philosophic work, to proceed at all smartly, wouldn't you agree, requires a controlled working space. Chartered companies are the ideal agents to provide that, be the shore Sumatran or Levantine or wherever globally, what matter? Control of the company perimeter is ever implicit. In any case, says Mason to Dixon, both Pennsylvania and Maryland are chartered companies as well, if it comes to that. Chartered companies may indeed be the form the world has now increasingly begun to take. And I thought 'twas a spheroid. Play, play, trouble yourself not with these matters. Mason shivers. Yet I never told you how much I admired you for going back to the Cape. For me, a journey impossible. Should some mischievous power, in this world or another, sentence me to repeat the experience, and knowing what I know now... There's the catch, of course, Dixon pretending to be calm. What? Knowing what thou know now, thou won't. That's part of the price, to drink from Lethe and lose all thy memories. Thou'll be considering the next world brand new, no? Never seen thou before, and thou'll go ahead and make the same mistakes, unless thou've brought along a remembrancer, as some would say, a conscience. Something stashed in thy bootstrap to get thee going upon a cold day. And cold shall it be, a part of thy soul that doesn't depend on memories, that lies further than memories. Mason regards him carefully. Something has happened back in Durham. He puts on a stuffy manner that Dixon might rise to. We don't have that in the church. Why, aye, you do. If there were as much silence in thy masses as in our meetings, 'twould be evident even to thee. You're saying we jabber too much for you? No time to meditate? Not Hindu enough? Bad music, too, I collect. Well, any silences in my church, thank you, are the sort most of us can't wait for to be over. All our worries, usually kept at bay by that protective murmur of sound, you see, come rushing in. Women, work, health, the authorities, anything but what you're talking about, whatever that be. Mason, shall we argue religious matters? Good Christ! Dixon, what are we about? Part 2. America. Chapter 26. For 40 years, the boundary dispute had lain in chancery, irresolute. As Penns and Baltimores were born and passed, and nothing ever seemed to move too fast, though Maryland's case be stronger on the merits, yet Penn's the friend at court of certain ferrets, who'll worry every dimly doubtful acre. The betting in the clubs is with the Quaker. Let judges judge and lawyers have their day, yet soon or late the line will find its way. For skies grow thick with aviating swine ere men pass up the chance to draw a line. So one day into Delaware's great basin with strange machinery sell Mr. Mason and Mr. Dixon by the Falmouth packet, connected as with some invisible bracket, sharing a fate directed by the stars to mark the earth with geometric scars. Timothy Talks, The Line. From the shore they will hear milkmaids quarreling and cowbells a-clank, and dogs and babies old and new, hammers upon nails, wives upon husbands, the ring of pot lids, the jingling of draft chains, a rifle shot from a stretch of woods, lengthily crackling tree to tree and across the water. An animal will come to a headland and stand, regarding them with narrowly set eyes that glow a moment, its face slowly turning as they pass. America. At sunset, they raise the Capes of Delaware and lie to for the night in Horkel Road, just inside Cape Henlopen. The astronomers hear rails whistling and a feral screaming in the brakes that the one imagines as heat and the other as slaughter, though they do not discuss this. Somewhere, a channel buoy rings. Reports arrive all night of lights upon the shore. Sailors prowl the decks, losing sleep. The sunrise comes chased beyond all easy wit. The coffee is brewed once and then poured through its own grounds again by Shorty, the cook. Among the morning breezes, Captain Falconer works his vessel back out between the hen and chickens and the shears to the main channel, and with a pilot willing to take packet wages aboard, begins threading among the bars and flats of Delaware Bay toward Newcastle, where the bay, narrowed by then to a river, takes its great 90-degree turn eastward. The town wheeling away to larboard brick, white, grayish-blue of a precise shade neither astronomer has ever seen, citizens and their children waving, horses a-clop upon the paving stones, white public trim work shifting like furniture upon the sky. Children, at that time Philadelphia was second only to London as the greatest of English-speaking cities. The ship's landing ran well up into the town by way of Dock Creek, so that the final approach was like being reached out to, the wind baffled, a slow embrace of brickwork, as the town came to swallow one by one their oceanic degrees of freedom, once as many as a compass boxed, and now as they single up all lines, as they secure from sea detail, as they come to rest, none. Here is danger's own home port, where mates swallow the anchor and have fatal failures of judgment, where a sailor who goes up an alley may not return the same swab at all. 'Tis the middle of November, though seeming not much different from a late English summer. It is an overcast evening, rain in the offing. In a street nearby, oysters from the Delaware shore are being cried by the wagon load. The surveyors stand together at the quarterdeck, Mason in gray stockings, brown breeches, and snuff-colored coat with pinchbeck buttons, Dixon in red coat, breeches and boots, and a hat with a severely military rake to it, waiting the instruments, both now more keenly than at any time during this late sea passage, feeling like supercargo, posed not before wild seas or exotic landscapes, but among objects of oceanic commerce. As all round them, sailors and dockmen labor, nets lift and sway as if by themselves, bulging with casks of nails and jellied eels, British biscuit and buttons for your waistcoat, tonics, colognes, golden provolones. Upon the docks, a mighty bustling proceeds as wagon drivers mingle with higher-born couples in Italian chaises, Negroes with hand barrels, Irish servants with cargo of all sorts upon their backs. Running dogs, rooting hogs, and underfoot lies all the debris of global traffic, shreds of spices and teas and coffee berries, splashes of Geneva gin and Queen of Hungary water, oranges and shaddocks fallen and squashed, seeds that have sprouted between the cobblestones, pills balsamic and universal, ground and scattered, down where the flies convene, and the spadger hops. Stevedores are carrying trunks down the planks, or rolling barrels down into wagons, where horses, not much different from British farm horses, stand awaiting loads and journeys. Thoroughbred cousins clitter clatter in, hauling an open carriage load of artfully dressed maidens, who do not seem to be related to anyone on board, coming prancingly alongside, smiling and waving at everyone they can see. These are Philadelphia girls, who, in the article of reckless flirtation, the surveyors will discover, put all the step-sitters of Cape Town quite in eclipse. Dixon, playing the rural booby, grins and waves his hat. "What cheer, Paul? Is it thou?" Philadelphia girls, Philadelphia ways, heavenly sights, Schuylkillside nights, and Philadelphia days. Debarking passengers are scrutinized by dockside visitors with varying motives. Some are actually there to meet passengers. Some have come to gather information. Others, with an interest in the category of traveler termed unwary, have passed the morning perfecting before pocket mirrors images of guilelessness. Appropriate elements hover about the cargoes of small but interesting items such as gemstones and medicines with pilferage in mind. Vendors of all sorts have set up to address the sailors 3 weeks at sea. Those who do not stroll these pitches one by one ignore them, streaking past, eager to be into town before evening's first illuminate windows. Pass it by, lads. 'Tis not for you. Why should you ever need this marvelous potion, praised by the most successful lovers of all time? You there, you've heard of Don Juan, Casanova, and how about old Q, the star of Piccadilly? What do you think keeps him so brisk, eh? Milkmaid in your pocket. Right there, Jack, me boy. Milkmaid in your pocket. Proving to be a curious portable cup equipped with a simple siphon for carrying about the liquid of one's choice upon which one may then suck. Whatever the circs during a card game, out in the street, back in the ship. Her name is Graziana, lads, a daughter of Naples. You that's been to Naples, and you that haven't, why, this is your chance. She may not speak a word of English, but there's something she can do, and she's doing it right now. See her handle it? See her flatten it? See her toss it twirling in the air, with all the female exuberance of her race. And we haven't even gotten to the skimmaws yet. The sign upon the wagon says it all, boys. Heaven or bust. Those are the choices. You've been out around the world, and you know it's true. Now what are you going to do about it? Go into another tavern, follow like a trained dog another flashing of satinette, wait one card too many to gather up even a few small coins, stumble back to the ship, single up all lines, out once again into certain danger. What do you think Jesus feels like when he sees you missing another chance like that? Oh, he's watching. He knows. The Reverend McClenahan, a rousing evangelist said to be much in the Whitefield mold, has just been through town, and the effects of his passage appear everywhere. Snooty urban Anglicans, for whom Christ has figured as a distant, minor saint, are suddenly upon the streets with their wigs askew, singing original hymns about rebirth in his blood. Presbyterians in great Conestoga wagons haunt the approaches to taverns and inns, gathering up sinners of all degrees and persuasions, taking them far out into the country, and subjecting them to intense sermonizing until they either escape, go to sleep, or find the true turning of heart that needs no authentication. Even Quakers are out in the street, bargaining with unexpected pugnacity for a share of this population suddenly roused into Christliness. The new religion had crested better than 20 years before, the Reverend Cherrycoke explains. By the 60s, we were well into a descent that grew more vertiginous with the days, ever toward some great trough whose terrible depth no one knew. Or yet knows, the intermittently gloomy Ethelmer. As so often, the Reverend finds himself looking for Tenebris' reactions to the thoughts of her cousin, the university man. All respect, sir, wouldn't the scientific thing have been to keep note, through the years after, of those claiming rebirth in Christ? To see how they did, how long the certainty lasted, to see who was telling the truth and how much of it. Oh, there were scoundrels about, to be sure, says the Reverend, claiming falsely for purposes of commerce an awakening they would not have recognized had it shouted to them by name. But enough people had shared the experience that charlatans were easily exposed. That was the curious thing, so many having been through it together. You should have seen this place the time Whitefield came. All Philadelphia, delirious with psalms. People standing up on ladders at the church windows, torchlight bright as midday. Direct experience of Christ, hitherto the painfully earned privilege of hermits in the desert, was in the instant, amid the best farmland on earth, being freely given to a great town of burghers and church folk. They need only accept. How could the world have remained right side up after days like those? 'Twas the Holy Ghost conducting its own settlement of America. George III might claim it, but 'twas the Ghost that ruled, and rules yet, even in deistic times. Say, Depew, considering, no wonder there was a revolution. Some revolution, remarks Euphrenia. Why, youth, cries her sister. How not, protests Ethelmer. Excuse me, ma'am, but as you must appreciate how even your sort of music is changing, recall what Plato said in his Republic. When the forms of music change, 'tis a promise of civil disorder. I believe his quarrel was with the dithyrambists, the Reverend smoothly puts in, who were not changing the forms of song, he felt, so much as mixing up one with another, or abandoning them altogether, as their madness might dictate. Just what I keep listening for, Thelmer, Euphrenia nods, in the songs and hymns of your own American day. Yet do I seek in vain after madness and rapture, hearing but a careful attending to the same forms, the same interests as of old. And have you noticed the way everything suddenly has begun to gravitate toward B-flat major? That's a sign of trouble ahead. Marches and anthems for triumphs that have not yet been made real. Already 'tis possible to walk the streets of New York, passing among buskers and mongers from one street air to the next, and whistle along, and never have to change key from B-flat major. Ah, and yet, if I may... The young man seats himself at the clavier and arpeggiates a few major chords. In C, if you like, here is something the fellows sing at university when we are off being merry. To Anacreon in heavens, its name, I'll spare ye the words, lest the innocence of any ear in the room be assaulted. Tenebrae has invented and refined a way of rolling her eyes, undetectable to any save her target, upon whom the effect is said to be devastating. Ethelmer's reaction is not easy to detect, save that he is blinking rapidly and forgets for a moment where middle C is. The air he plays to them would be martial but for its tempo, being more that of a minuet, 32 measures in all, which by its end has feet tapping and necks a sway. Here, I say, is the new form in its essence, four stanzas, sentimentally speaking, a sandwich with the third eight bars as the filling. That phrase, playing it, ascending like a skyrocket, its appeal to the emotions primitive as any experienced in the act of... cousin... of eating, that's all I was going to say. Hands spread in gawky appeal. She shakes her finger at him, though, as the Reverend can easily see, in naught but play. And this is the sort of thing you lads are up to, he avuncularly rumbles, out there over Delaware... Anatomizing your own drinking songs? Is nothing sacred, and is there not but a small skipping dance step till ye be questioning earthly, nay, heavenly powers? Something's astir in music anyway, quickly inserts Aunt Euphy,